We continue now with Sam Hamill, founding editor of Copper Canyon Press, director of the Port Townsend Writers Conference, poet, translator, and essayist who's published over a dozen volumes of original poetry, including Destination Zero, poems 1970 to 1995, Gratitude, and Dumb Luck. If one needed a sense of what the future holds for this culture, a glimpse at what has been done to Fort Worden 100 years after it was established as a military camp will provide it. The headquarters for a number of creative endeavors, including Centrum Arts Creative Education and Copper Canyon Press. We talk today to a man who runs the nonprofit Poetry Press in what was the Cannon Repair Shop at the old fort. Welcome back, Sam Hamill, to the program. An interesting change in 100 years. Is that all it takes to go from war to poetry is 100 years?
All of the bombs have become verbal.
Yeah, that's right. And more deadly, too, in many cases.
Strange place for a pacifist to spend 30 years.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful place because we can look at, how our tax dollars can be spent for the purposes of beauty and enlightenment rather than destroying life.
Watching what's happened here over three decades has been a great pleasure to me. Not just what happens in literature, but what happens in music and dance and all the arts and what happens when people come to visit and look around. It's a very civilizing place for an old army fort.
Do you get frustrated at trying to run a nonprofit press, struggling to make it work, and then seeing the amount of money year after year that gets increased in defense spending?
Well, that stuff will make you crazy. Steve Cusisto pointed out a couple of days ago that something like 36,000 children die every day of malnutrition in the world. I think it's much more than that. But when you start putting too much of that into your mind, it can sort of interfere with the real conduct of your own individual efforts to make the world a little better place to live. So on the one hand, while I'm aware of all of that stuff, my focus has always been sort of on my work today and today only, and attention to daily practice and daily detail.
And after doing it for over 30 years, you can see the actual fruits of your work.
We've published something like 260 books at Copper Canyon, and I've published 37 or 38 books of my own. So a little bit of daily detail isn't really a bad idea.
Yeah. Let's talk about the results you've seen from the Writers' Conference after all these years. Can you tell us about someone who came perhaps as a youth or as a young poet and maybe someone you're publishing?
Well, there are an infinite number of people who have come here and continued on with their writing lives. If I began a list simply of the faculty members and think of all of the great old Northwest writers who have been here, many of whom are now dearly departed, like Bill Stafford and Dick Hugo, and Carolyn Kaiser is still very much with us. And Kenneth Rexroth was here, and Phil Whalen, who died a couple of weeks ago, and taught here. And Gary Snyder has taught here, and Maxine Kuhlman, who's not a Northwesterner, taught here. The list is just, it's huge and it's long, and the influence is almost incalculable because a lot of people who come here and take the 10-day writing workshop go back and spend their active lives in the classroom, taking into the classroom many of the practices that they were engaged in here. So there's a kind of snowball effect to that kind of teaching.
Quite often when one throws a party, that person doesn't really get to enjoy the party. So can you tell us what you get out of the Writers' Conference besides the lower IQ, as you mentioned earlier, and sleep deprivation, which I'm sure is a part of it?
Well, I get IOD on lectures and poetry and crowds and all the rest of it, but I'm kind of a famous recluse. I'm not a real social animal. I love this conference, and I've given a good portion of my life to it the last 6 years. What I have learned myself from this conference, frankly, is incalculable. Many friendships that last a lifetime were born with this conference. So it's a lot of hard work, and in the future I'll be doing less of it. I'll probably become more of an advisor to the conference rather than its director because I would like to have more of a writing life, and I can't run Copper Canyon and the Writers' Conference and have a complete writing life. It's just too much work for one man.
You're starting poets off at 8:30 in the morning with a lecture.
Well, I've been up for 3 hours. It's time they went to work.
I knew it. I knew it had something to do with that. You know, in Taos, it starts at 3. No, actually,
if it were my writing conference, I'd run it like a Zen boot camp, and they would all be up at 5 a.m. They would have their tea, and they would go to work.
Yes, and enrollment would go down, I'm sure. Well, in some ways, I guess.
No one has complained about an 8:30 lecture. We moved that time back a little bit, frankly, so they would have another half hour in the classroom. And I think that's a great benefit.
You moved it from 9 to 8:30.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that, to provide more time.
To extend the actual workshop time a half an hour a day.
Talking with Sam Hamill, the founding editor of Copper Canyon Press and the director of the Port Townsend Writers Conference, where we're at this week, enjoying the ambiance at Fort Worden here in Port Townsend, Washington. I'm Paul Nelson. You know, we talked last time about William Carlos Williams, that quote, "There is no poetry of distinction without formal invention." And one person who did not get the credit he likely deserves in his role in pushing the art forward is a man named Kenneth Rexroth, a man forever linked to the San Francisco Renaissance of the 40s and 50s, a movement that made way for the Beat Generation, though Rexroth probably lived to regret that. He was a man who literally helped save your life. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I was a 15-year-old kid who'd read Rexroth's poetry and Ferlinghetti's poetry and Jack Kerouac's On the Road. And when I was 15 years old in 1957 or 58, I went to San Francisco to be a beatnik. And like most kids who do stuff like that, I ended up almost self-destructing. And I ended up living on the streets, and I had a heroin habit. I was just getting a heroin habit. And I happened to run into Kenneth, and he realized that I was stoned, and we got to talking, and it was through my relationship with him and his friendship that I was installed for a while in his wonderful house on Scott Street, where I sort of got introduced to the serious side of what it might mean to be a poet. And that's really sort of when I began looking at my life and how I wanted to live it.
And many years later, what, 44 years later, you're publishing his collected poems.
We just were about to publish it. It'll be published in late September. 900 and some pages of really remarkable poetry, one of the great poets of the last century, certainly.
Including work that's never been published before.
Some work that's never been published, not a lot, but it's the first time you've been able to see it all front to back in pretty much the right order.
In one big book.
One big book. A book you can spend the rest of your life reading.
It's a true story, yeah.
Yeah.
Yet this is another example of some of the benefits of being a nonprofit literary press than a for-profit. Tell us
exactly. New Directions, of course, published Kenneth all of his life. And he was very close friends with Jay Lachlan, the late dear Jay Lachlan, the founder and master of New Directions. But to publish this big book takes a whole lot of money, and New Directions would have to sell this book for $60 or $70 a copy probably, and we'll sell it probably for $40. So we can do that simply because people help us make that possible by donating time and money.
Could you give us an example of his work?
Well, I wanted to bring actually two poems. Kenneth was known for his political poems. He was known for his love poems, known for his translations, known for his jazz poems. So what does one pick? Well, I picked a little short poem that sort of has a little bit of bearing on music. This is called A Flute Overheard, one of the later poems. Gray summer, low tide, the sea and the air, a flute song in a neighboring house. 40 years ago, Socrates on death, the pages turn, the clear voice, sea fog and the cypress. My daughter calls from the next room. After 40 years, a girl's candid face above my desk, 25 years dead, gray summer fog and the smell of the living sea, a voice on the moving air, reading Socrates on death.
Becomes a lot more poignant after a man's gone when reading his words like that.
Well, you know, I should give you a little bit of my rich little Rexroth. I always thought he sounded a little bit like W.C. Fields. He used to get just mad as hell at me when I do that. He'd get on one of his political tirades, he'd sound something like this. These running dogs of the capitalist bourgeoisie. But when I read his poems like that, it sort of pushes my body away from the poetry. So it's hard for me to read his poems in his voice because I'm so used to reading them in my own voice.
So, Kenneth, do you like capitalists? Yeah, with an apple in their mouth, yes, indeed, or something like that. Yeah, there was a quote. Oh boy, did I write it down? Something about the purpose of the poet. I have it written down in the book. Oh, here it is. He said, "I write a couple of different things. I write poetry to seduce women and overthrow the capitalist system in that order."
That's right. In fact, he said that here at the Port Townsend Conference when we had him here. I think it was about 1978. A nice little white-haired lady in the audience didn't understand why he was on a political tirade and stood up and said, "Mr. Rexroth, I just don't understand why you write poetry." "My dear, I write poetry to seduce women and overthrow the capitalist system in that order."
Do you think we would have been better off if he reversed that order?
Not necessarily.
No? It wouldn't have happened anyway.
You know, I think that one of the things I learned from Kenneth is that is the value of friendship. And whatever else he was, Kenneth generally loved women. And he often didn't behave altogether well. But he was a feminist before that word was invented. And he really cared about everybody in his way. But he especially cared about people who had that artist thing going. And you got to remember, in his age, there were no women poets except Edna St. Vincent Millay and Elizabeth Bishop, maybe. And certainly the people outside academia were non-existent on the literary horizon. He spent his whole life encouraging young women writers especially, but all young writers. And when he died, he left a little bit of foundation money to establish a scholarship for young Japanese women writers.
Yeah. I want to cover more about that. I want to cover more about his friendship. He, in the introduction to Sacramental Axe, his love poems on Copper Canyon Press, there is a quote that said, after he moved from San Francisco, he said, "I live 40 years in San Francisco and haven't had a real friend to show for it."
Well, he felt kind of betrayed and isolated by the time he left San Francisco. Kenneth had a number of psychological problems, probably the most severe of which was his paranoia. And he would sometimes call Jay Lachlan in the middle of the night saying that, you know, the New York Times is out to get me. That's a disorder. And if we took him today to see a psychiatrist, they could probably give him a pill the way they have Hayden Carruth to deal with Hayden's paranoia and chronic depression. Hayden functions pretty well with the help of medication. I think it would have changed Kenneth's life. And unfortunately, his paranoia damaged a lot of friendships. But if you talk to Gary Snyder today, it's evident in everything Gary says, the great love and affection that he has for Kenneth and how much he learned from Kenneth, how much Kenneth helped shape his character and his poetry.
Yeah, and we had Jerome Rothenberg at our Spoken Word Lab about a year or so ago. And when he talks about Rexroth, the smile lights up his face.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Kenneth was a great joy about 98% of the time. Unfortunately, about 2% of the time, he was haywire. And some people didn't understand that he was just a little bit crazy, and it hurt their relationships.
Did that craziness help his work?
Oh, in some ways, I think, sure. I think all of us who labor to be working artists are a little bit crazy. Why else would we do this?
You're not talking metaphorically either.
No, I'm certainly not. No, absolutely not. I think that many of us have all kinds of diagnosable disorders. I've wrestled all my life with chronic depression. One of the reasons I'm so close to Hayden is I really understand his depression because I share something of it.
Yeah, but we also live in a society that is trained to look, you know, medical system that's trained to look for the bad part. Find the bad part and kill it might be the motto.
Well, and, you know, if you look at the way we treat working artists, you look at the way they're profiled. When was the last time you saw a poet treated with any sense of respect in the American mass media? when was the last time you saw a poet portrayed in a movie in which he wasn't just totally screwing? Yeah. But I think one of the things that drives someone to be a great musician or a great poet or a great artist is that need to connect. And I know that for me, as an orphan and as a battered child, I really identify with Kenneth's struggle to get straight with women. He was horribly battered by his grandmother after his mother died when he was very young. And it tormented him all his life, this sort of battered child syndrome and this feeling like he was never quite enough for someone or quite enough to make the actual relationship. But his poetry is full of profound understanding about those relationships that are realizations made possible because of what he had been through.
Yeah. And in Rex Roth's poem, A Letter to William Carlos Williams, he said, the role of the poet is one who creates sacramental relationships that last always.
We used to argue about that. I used to say, Kenneth, the poet doesn't create those relationships. He explores them. She identifies them. She articulates them. But the poet doesn't create those relationships. Those relationships are there organically.
He or she documents them.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's been said that, you talk about his relationship with women, and it's been said that his translating of the poetry of Chinese and Japanese women transformed his heart and mind.
You know, Elliot Weinberger says that at the end of his life, Kenneth almost became a woman. In a way, that's almost true. When I talk about Kenneth the feminist, a lot of it comes out of translating Li Jingzhao and the women poets of Japan, the women poets of China. It had a very profound effect on his late poetry.
Has translating had an effect on your life?
Oh, absolutely. Translating has really sort of shaped my life. I'm a practicing Zen Buddhist. All of that came to me in translation.
Yeah. You have another one of his poems selected.
Yeah, I thought I'd read one of Kenneth's later love poems. This is Confusion of the Senses. Moonlight fills the laurels like music. The moonlit air does not move. Your white face moves towards my face. Voluptuous sorrow holds us like a cobweb, like a song, a perfume, the moonlight. Your hair falls and holds our faces. Your lips curl into mine. Your tongue enters my mouth. A bat flies through the moonlight. The moonlight fills your eyes. They have neither iris nor pupil. They are only globes of cold fire, like the deer's eyes that go by us through the empty forest. Your slender body quivers and smells of seaweed. We lie together, listening to each other breathing in the moonlight. Do you hear? We are breathing. We are alive.
You can just feel his energy from that. You can just absolutely feel the passion from that.
Wonderful poem. Gorgeous poem. What kind of poetry you can write only when you're a 70-year-old man, still very much in love.
What an honor it must be to repay the kindness he showed you by saving your life when you were a 15-year-old
astronaut. Well, that's really not the way I see it. It would be nice if it were that simple. But what I see my job as doing is bringing this poetry that's kind of been overlooked in recent years, bringing it back to the forefront and saying, remember, here is the complete works of one of the great poets of our time.
Why do you think he's been overlooked?
Oh, he was outside the academy. He was outside the literary establishment. He was a solitary man in many ways. He was difficult to deal with sometimes. All of the above.
Yeah.
You know, when Time magazine called him the grandfather of the Beats, his response was, an entomologist is not a bug.
Yeah. And yet people give him credit for shaping the culture of the West Coast.
Well, Ferlinghetti, I asked Lawrence for a little comment for this book, and his comment was very clear and to the point. Rex Roth is the father of us all.
Well, much success.
Or the master of us all, I think he said.
Yeah. Continued success with his work.
He was the most well-read human being I've ever met. He read positively everything. And his two-volume Classics Revisited is basically a BA in humanities just by reading the books as he discusses them. I mean, he was a remarkable mind.
Well,
54 books he wrote.
I look forward to seeing the book when it's out.
Thanks.
And I wish you continued success with your work here at the press and the conference.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Sam Hamill, founding editor of Copper Canyon Press, director of the Port Townsend Writers Conference. We've been talking about Kenneth Rexroth, whose collected poems are coming out by Copper Canyon later this year. CopperCanyonPress.org, the website for more information. Our thanks to Synergy Sound and Neville Pearsall for the use of the studios here on the campus of Fort Worden. And more information, a link to Copper Canyon Press on our website at inpeoria.org.